It's wonderful to be here. I never imagined some 3 years ago that I would be in Tashkent and discussing the relationship between the International Labour Organization and the government of Uzbekistan. And very interestingly, some 3 years ago, the international community, including some top human rights organizations, were lobbying to let you work here, to find a way for the ILO to work closely with the government of Uzbekistan. How did that happen?
How did that happen? Well, first of all, you're right. These are very interesting times in Uzbekistan. And things that we didn't think would be possible just a year ago or 2 years ago, today are perfectly normal. And so there is a lot of very positive things happening. So Uzbekistan has been a member of the ILO for 26 years. And our work on the cotton harvest began in 2013, where we looked at primarily child labor in the cotton harvest. In 2015, we expanded our focus on the cotton harvest to also include forced labor. And so the project that I'm responsible for, the ILO third-party monitoring project, was initiated in we did our first monitoring to also look at forced labor, primarily in the context of the World Bank project sites. But we've always conducted our monitoring nationwide in all provinces and in all districts.
You seem to have the closest relationship now with the Uzbek government. You're a major player here in Tashkent. And I'm actually complimenting you because, many international organizations, we have to openly recognize the fact that they have struggled to find a common language with the Uzbek government, to communicate with the system. And you seem to have found that golden mean. The Uzbek government speaks very highly of you. They trust you. They are relying heavily on you as we approach this new cotton season. They are completely counting on your support. But as far as I know, this is not an unconditional support.
No, well, I think you're right. First of all, it's important to understand who the ILO is. So we are a little different from other UN agencies in that we work through our tripartite constituents. So we do work with governments, but we also work with employers and worker organizations, trade unions. So we work through a tripartite structure. So other UN agencies are closer to perhaps the government alone, but in the ILO we have a tripartite structure.
So in any country, the government is not your sole ally.
Exactly.
You
This
need
is the
other
thing.
partners.
We always work through our tripartite structure.
And how independently can you operate like that?
I am happy to say, and I think this is an important topic, we have complete independence. Nobody is trying to restrict our operations on the ground here in Uzbekistan. There is no attempt to influence or, how can you say, control the monitoring process of the cotton harvest. So I think that's, and we can talk more about exactly what that means. But I think it's also important to stress that we do monitoring of the cotton harvest, but we also do a lot of training and capacity building pre-harvest, part of which I think you're familiar with, the training of journalists this year. We've also trained public prosecutors and the Minister of the Interior and human rights activists, and we have trained people involved in the recruitment for the cotton harvest.
And is training a part of your regular work? Do you do this in other countries too, or is this
Absolutely.
something specific for Uzbekistan?
Yes. I think this is something we do worldwide, and we can take some of the best practices and apply them here in Uzbekistan. I think, quite frankly, that Uzbekistan is turning out to be a bit of a pathfinder in the ILO system, because many of these learnings that we see in Uzbekistan, I believe, can be applied in other countries where you have similar issues.
The government of Uzbekistan has always argued that the problem of forced labor in this country, which is something that they failed to recognize for a long time, of course, the existence of forced labor, they have always argued that this is such a unique case. Like, we're such a special case. Like, treat us differently. Don't judge us based on those regular international standards. Is this such a unique situation? Because
First of all, let me pick up on what you said first. I think today we're in a situation where we have very straightforward conversations with the government and with everybody else in Uzbekistan. Nobody is trying to talk down the fact that there is a forced labor issue, and this is what we're working together to eradicate. So I think what may or may not have happened in the past has certainly changed into the situation today, where we have completely open conversations about this.
So the old arguments are not valid anymore.
I don't know what you mean by the old argument, but
that we are very special, like, you know, don't judge us based on the international experience. The relationship between cotton and the people of Uzbekistan is very unique.
You see, the issue of involuntary or forced labor can take many different shapes and forms in different countries. So, for example, ILO is also working in Thailand on issues related to the fishery project, where you have people working in forced labor, trapped in forced labor situation on fishing vessels, and they can be out at sea for quite extended periods of time. That is a different situation than picking cotton for 4 to 6 weeks during the cotton harvest here in Uzbekistan. There are also different recruitment mechanisms, and some of it involves migrant labor, and some of it doesn't. Here in Uzbekistan, there's no migrant labor of workers coming into the country to pick cotton. So you have different flavors, if you like. You have different types of forced labor. The principles are the same. If you pick against your will, and if you fear, or if you believe that there would be some negative consequences if you decline an invitation to pick, then it's forced labor, and it's really not very complicated.
And can you confidently say that you and the Uzbek government are on the same page in terms of understanding what is forced labor?
The conversations we have had since the 2017 harvest and going into 2018, yes, I can say that we are completely on the same page. We do not have any misunderstandings about what the ILO conventions say, what the Uzbek laws and regulations say, and where the issues are. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We have full transparency and full cooperation from the Uzbek government.
And who are some of your closest partners now that are non-governmental here in the country?
So this is a good question. So we traditionally, as I said, we would work through government structures, like, for example, the Ministry of Labor. We would also work through trade unions, so the Federation of Trade Unions, and the Chamber of Commerce and Industry, representing the employers. What we are also doing in Uzbekistan is that we have other key partners, such as civil society. We work very closely with independent civil society activists. We work very closely with journalists from various types of media. And we work very closely with other types of civil society registered organizations. So we have a broader spectrum than just the tripartite.
What would you say to those who are basically criticizing you for selecting certain groups only to partner with? Like, how do you choose your partners? Do you go to them based on their work? Or is this, obviously, it's a two-way street. They have to be willing to work with you too. But what is the process like? How transparent is that process?
We're very transparent in terms of who we work with. Obviously, when it comes to dealing with the cotton harvest, there are some players you have to deal
people
with.
People are very emotional.
They're emotional, yes. But just to give you an idea, this year, we will be doing monitoring jointly with human rights activists, independent, unregistered human rights activists who form part of some of these international networks that are also interested in this area. We will be doing monitoring with these people. We are very open to cooperation, and we by no means want to be selective in who we're dealing with.
And when it comes to the processing of all that information that gets collected, mm-hmm. How is that process like? Do you do that together with them, or do you then take everybody's input and then analyze it yourself?
Oh, that's a very good question. Thanks for asking. So let me sort of explain to you how we gather our data, how we manage it, and how we analyze it. So let's use the 2018 harvest as an example. So this year, we will be conducting some 11,000 interviews. Last year, we conducted 4,000 interviews, so we're doing even more this
almost
year.
Almost three times more.
Almost three times
more. And
this
is across the country.
This is across the country in all provinces and all
at
regions.
At the same time? Or?
During the harvest. Mm. So actually, this year, we are also looking at the weeding cotton weeding season, which takes place in May, June. And so that's included this year in the monitoring. The harvest itself runs September, October into November. And during that phase, we are also conducting these interviews. We conduct many different types of interviews. We do field interviews face-to-face in the cotton fields by international ILO experts that we fly into the country. This year we're going to be doing these interviews jointly with local human rights activists and, of course, the Federation of Trade Unions, who, by the way, recused themselves completely from the interview process. There is no interference. There is no nobody knows where we are going to do these interviews. So the interviews are unannounced and unaccompanied completely.
And the government is okay with that?
Absolutely.
Including the Ministry of Labor?
Including the Ministry of Labor and beyond. Yes, we have full support. And I think this is important. There's no attempt to hide anything. Certainly, we saw this beginning in 2017. There was an openness. And it followed the president's speech at the United Nations General Assembly, where he very openly talked about these issues. And in 2018, I think we have reached a stage now where, we have no attempt to interfere with the process.
You have some harsh critics, obviously. Mm-hmm. Some of them are your partners, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, for example, the cotton campaign. Mm-hmm. You consider them a partner.
Absolutely, yeah. Of course. Yes.
And you have had many conversations with them mm-hmm. over the last year. And their delegation visited Uzbekistan
yes.
last May. They
mm-hmm.
had a good visit, they
good.
Tell us.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not rushing to paint such a positive picture of the environment mm-hmm. Here.
Mm-hmm.
They think that to conclude that forced labor problem is resolved or on the way to be resolved, it would be too much.
Mm-hmm.
That we need more, we need to see more proof, we need to see more results. And they also feel like the government, the system is not in sync in its approach to mm-hmm. the issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not for me to speak on behalf of the cotton campaign or speculate about why they may have certain certain perspectives on things. But yes, we do consider the cotton campaign a partner. I think it's important to realize that everybody has a right to be interested in these issues. And that includes the cotton campaign, it includes activists and citizens of Uzbekistan, it includes organizations, and everybody has a right to be interested in labor issues. There's no monopoly for the ILO to work on these issues. So yes, we do consider.
And you have encouraged the Uzbek government to work with them, right?
Of course.
To work with the
well, look,
campaign.
We encourage an open process and involving people and work together to solve this this issue. This is a complex issue that requires everybody to work together, which is also why this year, when we conducted international training on investigation techniques, we didn't just train government officials. We trained journalists from independent media in Uzbekistan on investigative methods. We trained human rights activists. We trained people from the Ministry of the Interior, labor inspectors, people from the trade unions and the Chamber of Commerce. So we brought everybody together. We took them to Italy, provided training for them, and then we replicated the training here back in Uzbekistan. This is an issue which you can't monitor your way out of. Monitoring is not a solution. Monitoring is simply a tool. So when we come to building that capacity, we need to really work quite broadly.
But your reports based on that monitoring play a huge role in terms of the policy making here.
Of course.
You get quoted a lot by the Uzbek government.
Of course.
And they claim that based on your monitoring, the issue is no longer there.
I must disagree. I don't think anybody is saying this is no longer an issue. Quite the contrary. I think everybody is now realizing that there is an issue, and this is something that will take. But it's not for me to speculate about how long time it will take. But it's clear that there's no easy fix for this issue. I think the government, if you follow the Uzbek media, is very open about that. This is not just confined to the cotton harvest. There are, of course, issues with street sweeping and
there isn't much discussion about the details of your report. I mean, you reported last year that there have been thousands of cases of violations, big and small, in different parts of the country.
Yes, yes.
And some of them were tackled and some of them need to be tackled.
Mm-hmm.
You don't really hear that discussion in the local media. They pick on the points, the bigger points where the issue is recognized, the government wants to resolve this issue, mm-hmm. government wants to work,
yes,
both with the international community and local NGOs, to overcome this, you know, fundamental agricultural issue, you know, for the country. So I think a lot of the criticism stems from the fact that the Uzbeks are really picking certain things about the report and not.
I think everybody can pick certain things from reports and use
the facts
to enforce a certain perspective. I do think, Nabor, if you look at what we saw in 2017, is that we saw an increase in critical reporting coming out of certain news organizations in Uzbekistan, some of which are independent.
That's true.
Yes.
That's true. New media have started reporting on
They started issues. Reporting in 2017, and that prompted our approach to actually train journalists this year. And so, as you know, we trained 500 journalists across the country, and we also trained the communications officials from some of the government institutions who need to be communicating with the journalists.
So this year is going to be a very challenging time for everyone, I mean, including journalists and others. Challenging in a sense that we need to see the results of all these attempts and programs and
yes, challenging, but also exciting and important. So this year we are launching an award process where we will be recognizing the news organization or journalist that does the best reporting on forced labor in the cotton harvest. And the fact that we're doing this, I think, speaks to the changes that we're seeing for the media. So we will be recognizing, and we will have a ceremony at the end of the harvest where we will recognize the journalists and news organizations that do the best reporting. This is important for two reasons. One is to raise awareness of the average citizen of Uzbekistan. What are your rights? And the second one is, of course, to play the role as a watchdog. That's the role of the media. And so we believe that having that independent investigative reporting is important. That's why we are launching this process.
And I'm sure you have seen the recommendations from the Cotton Campaign following their visit.
Mm-hmm.
They are one of the major players, as you know, and the campaign has been effective internationally, you know, speaking. What did you think? I mean, do you think that those recommendations are doable or acceptable or realistic enough?
Well, it's not for me to.
No, but as a partner.
I think, in general, many of the recommendations make sense. I do think that it is important to not just write recommendations down on a piece of paper. That's easy. Actually, working on the ground and working on implementation and making that change real is where the challenge lies. So I think that's important. There has to be a follow up in terms of working on the ground in the country to actually change people's thinking, change people's behavior, and change the systems.
Mm-hmm. And you have also argued, including on social media, by the way, that pressure doesn't work. Like, you know, the kind of pressure or the kind of lecturing, perhaps, from the outside.
I don't think I said that pressure doesn't work, but I think there's a time and a place for pressure, and there's a time and a place for working to build capacity and to actually support. I think what we're seeing is a shift in terms of openness and commitment from the Uzbek government, starting at the very top. I think we are having a very different conversation, and we're having openness about this is an issue and we want to address it, we want to work together to eradicate it. In a situation like that, my opinion is that you don't need to keep the same level of pressure when you're having these very open discussions. Rather, you need to support and you need to help to build that capacity.
I was a part of some of the trainings, mm-hmm. and those sessions were really very impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And you had a lot of young people involved in the process.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really interesting to see people wearing those t-shirts and caps that say that my labor is not forced.
Yes.
That, you know, this I want to do this work.
Mm-hmm.
Don't make me, you know, don't force me to do this work. And I believe that these boxes have those t-shirts and caps. So should we prepare ourselves to see more of those?
Yes, I do apologize for the mess in our office.
Okay.
These are actually 20,000 caps with these logos.
For this season.
Your work's your choice. It's about voluntary labor.
In Uzbek.
You have a right in Uzbek. And these we're going to distribute out across the country to people in the fields. it serves two purposes. You get the message out there in the fields, and secondly, the caps actually provide shade for people when they're out in the sun.
And it's in white.
And it's in white, so it keeps people hopefully a bit cooler. So yes, that's right. That's the that's just a small part of the awareness raising campaign. And I like what you said about indeed you were part of the training of these journalists, and so was Human Rights Watch. We work openly with Human Rights Watch on a number of issues, and I think it's very, very good to see Human Rights Watch active on the ground in Uzbekistan, having an impact. So we're very happy with that cooperation.
So you would be willing to continue joint projects with Human Rights Watch?
Absolutely.
And if the cotton campaigns wants to come and do something together, you're open for that?
We are open to working with anybody who's willing to work with us, and we've done it in the past, as you say, and it's worked very well, and it's been welcomed by the government and by stakeholders in Uzbekistan. So yes, that's definitely something we are open to.
The child labor issue, you concluded, I think 2 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, that is no longer such a huge fundamental problem, that the child labor has been tackled with to a great extent.
Thank you for raising this point. I think it's important to be very specific here. Systematic child labor in the cotton harvest in Uzbekistan is no longer an issue. You do not see mass mobilization of school children picking cotton. That's a thing of the past. It does not happen today. Of course, as in any agricultural setting, anywhere in the world, you do have isolated cases of underage workers, and it's but it's not to an extent that is any more significant than it is in most other countries. And of course, agriculture is a high risk sector, especially in these peak situations such as the harvest. So, just to be clear, we believe, and we firmly believe, that there is no systematic child labor in the Uzbek cotton harvest. There are isolated cases, and we found some during our monitoring. But what we also saw was a systematic follow-up to those cases to immediately make sure that the situation is rectified, the child is looked after, it's investigated what happened, and made sure it doesn't happen again. So I think it's time to move on from that conversation, not to forget about child labor. Anywhere in the world is a big issue, but it's not a systematic part of the cotton harvest.
And we know that people do get paid for picking cotton.
Yes, yes.
And that paid system is expected to widen this year.
Yes.
How much are people going to make per kilo?
Okay, so this is exactly. So what we saw in 2016, people were paid 280 sums per kilo. In 2017, that went up to 450 sums per kilo in the first pass, so in the first round of picking. We have received information that this year it's going to go up to the region of 650 to 700 sums per kilo for the first pass.
So you can see 10 cents per kilo.
I think it's important to put this into perspective. I think it would not be fair to simply translate that into dollars and then put it into an American context or a European context for that matter.
A loaf of bread, let's say.
Well,
a kilo would get a loaf of bread in Uzbekistan.
Exactly. So to make things, to put things into perspective.
But that rate is not decided in cooperation with you, right? I mean, that's
We are not in the business of setting rates.
Who comes up with that?
This is the government sets the rate.
The
Ministry of Finance, I believe, is part of the group that sets that rate, yes. Obviously, there are many different impacts and calculations. There's also the price that the farmer is paid for the raw cotton, et cetera, et cetera.
But would you interfere if you thought that that's too low?
We can't interfere, and it's not our role to interfere and to tell. We would have a view if we felt that it came below, say, the minimum wage levels that are set sort of as a standard. But as a matter of fact, a reasonably productive cotton picker can pick and earn in the region of what, say, a nurse or a school teacher earns. So it's for women in the rural areas, this is actually quite an opportunity to earn a cash income.
Seasonal work.
Seasonal work. And that is exactly what we find, that the vast majority of the cotton pickers are voluntary. And the majority of the voluntary pickers are women from the rural areas who have an opportunity once in a year, basically, to earn cash. And so that's part of the explanation. And it's not insignificant what these women, who are often highly productive, can earn. It may not seem like a lot if you translate it and put it into an American context, but in Uzbekistan, this will go a long way to provide for school equipment, for food, for products to support the family.
There are obviously other kinds of forced labor in the country. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're focused, you're preoccupied mm-hmm. with the cotton sector.
Mm-hmm.
But are there any other forced labor related issues that also bother you in Uzbekistan that you need to pay attention?
Well, I think it's very clear from the conversations and the public statements from the president and from the prime minister and everybody in the central government that yes, there are issues. Primarily staff from state budget organizations being involved in things like street sweeping and cleaning and so on and so forth. And there's been some the statements made not only by the president, but also from everybody in the central government. The clear policy message is this is unacceptable. It is not permitted, and it's unacceptable to engage people in any form of forced labor. And there's actually, I would argue, a systematic effort to implement and enforce that across the country. You may still see cases, but there is the government policy is crystal clear.
And we hear from the government that executing the policy, executing the decrees, let's say the presidential decrees, that's very slow. That process is very slow. We heard President Mirziyoyev say on the eve of the Independence Day that, you know, we're yet to deliver on the promises we have made to the people of Uzbekistan, and that seems to be the biggest issue as far as the government is concerned. How do we enact all these laws? How do we execute all these decrees? Do you get to advise on those issues to the Uzbek government? Or, you know,
I think
they consult you? What would be, like, what is the practice like? I mean, obviously, Uzbekistan is a huge country.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big society. It's a very complex society. And enactments and executions, obviously, are very difficult in any sector.
Mm-hmm.
But what would be your advice in this process of reforms to achieve things, you know, to get to the results faster?
Yeah. Well, look, I think that it's good that the president is keeping the pressure on and expressing the need for further work. I think that's very positive, first of all. I think that also shows you the degree of openness and frankness there is in these
realistic
discussions.
Realistic approach.
Look, I think you have to start with political commitment. It's clear that there's political commitment to eradicate these issues, the forced labor issues in Uzbekistan. There's no doubt about it. Then you need to have the regulatory framework in place. Uzbekistan has the regulatory framework in place. Uzbekistan has ratified all the 14 ILO core conventions, eight core conventions. Uzbekistan has implemented these conventions into Uzbek law and even the constitution. So I think in terms of the regulatory framework, that's in place. Then you need the capacity to actually enforce these rules. And we're working very closely with the Labour Inspectorate, with the Prosecutor's Office, and with independent watchdogs, such as journalists and human rights activists, to begin to really make sure that these laws and regulations are enforced and there are consequences when people don't follow them. But I think more importantly, but it's also important to keep in mind that making people change the way things are done takes time, and we know it from ourselves. It's really changing behavior in a profound way takes time, and it's not something that you just flick a switch and then everybody starts doing things differently. There needs to be a process of bringing people along. There needs to be a process of capacity building, of training, of education, to make sure that people understand the bigger picture and understand why it's important to change behavior.
Which are the ministries that you've been working closely with? Because you know, to actually tackle an issue like this, you have to be so well connected with so many parts of the system, right? The, not just the Ministry of Labor, but Ministry of Justice, Internal Affairs.
Internal Affairs.
Ministry of Economy, Agriculture.
Even the Ministry of Education and Health, of course. Yes, you're right. So it's important, of course, to engage many, many different types of ministries and governmental bodies and non-governmental institutions as well. So, and we do that. So in Uzbekistan, there is a coordination council on forced and child labor, to eradicate forced and child labor. That coordination council is chaired by Deputy Prime Minister Nabayeva, that I believe you interviewed last year. And so it's chaired by the Deputy Prime Minister. It has representatives from all organizations that are involved in the cotton harvest, in the cotton production, including all the ministries we just talked about. And it also, as a new thing, and this is really very positive, it now also has representation from civil society. And we're talking about independent, non-registered human rights activists who are part of the process.
The critical side.
The critical side. And we have, you know, been able to facilitate this process. And the government has been very open, very willing to work with everybody. Because at the end of the day, we share the same goal. We want to eradicate forced and child labor. So these people, the critical voices, have been allowed and are now formally part of the Coordination Council. They are able to follow the process, make interventions, ask questions, and really be part of the process. So I think this is important. This is an open, inclusive process.
Mm. And so the you don't feel challenged in let's say in maintaining communication with all these different parties.
No, we don't actually. I mean, we obviously we meet people very frequently, and we have these coordination council meetings where we have the formal process. In addition to that, of course, we speak on a daily basis with everybody who's concerned about these issues. We don't feel any difficulties in communicating, and we don't feel any restrictions either. We are completely free to talk to everybody we want to talk to.
I see that, you know, you don't have a big office here, and your staff is also quite small.
Yes.
Do you have people working with you in the regions?
Yes, we do. So, you're right. The project that we're working with, of course, ILO as an organization has a lot of expertise that we can tap into in Geneva, in Moscow, in other parts of the world. We have experts on forced labor, on child labor, on all these issues. So we can tap into this network of experts. So because this is a seasonal effort, we fly in 12 to 14 ILO experts into the country for the harvest to do the monitoring. And likewise, when we do the training and the capacity building, we fly people in. In the regions, we have networks, of course, from various types of organizations. We have consultants we work with. We work with a lot of people.
And you make sure that your experts, obviously foreign experts, international experts, are free enough or comfortable enough to work in these very local environments. You know?
Yes.
Because from the other side, you know, in the eyes of the locals, like foreigners are coming, you know, having a limited conversation with us through translations, and the feeling is that they usually get to hear the good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that the that communication is limited, interviews can be prepped, so, you know, you don't really get to say your story.
Look, I understand that view, and I think it's important, first of all, to stress that we don't rely alone on flying foreign experts in. We have many, many different ways of tapping into to people's opinions. We do follow social media, we do telephone polls, we do focus groups, we do all these 11,000 interviews conducted in very many different ways and means. We have open trainings. We trained 7,000 people this year across every single province and every single district of the country. We conducted training sessions where people could come and participate and ask questions and be part of the training. So we understand that you need local expertise, you need local knowledge, and so we're very sensitive to that. I think that's also why, at the end of the day, it's about building capacity of local journalists, of the labor inspectorate, of the trade unions, of the employers. Everybody needs to be part of it. It's not something that you can fly experts in. It's a temporary measure and simply one that we mainly use for the capacity building pre-harvest and the monitoring during the harvest.
How long have you been here? When did you start this assignment?
So the project has been running since, we've been working on these issues in 2013. The project here started in 2015, and I've been here for the last 1.5 years.
And how much did you know about Uzbekistan before starting on this job?
I knew some things, but I think I was probably very typical in that not many people in the world fully understand Uzbekistan, and I'm sure you're facing this on a daily basis yourself. So. I think there is...
Many Uzbeks don't understand Uzbekistan.
Maybe so. But I think for us who are lucky enough and privileged enough to be able to work here during this fascinating time and historic years of the country, we have an obligation, I believe, to talk openly internationally, to share information, and to be very open about what we are witnessing, because we are in a very unique position.
So you arrived in 2015 when the approach... was perhaps at the early stages of changing towards the problem. So you've seen the evolution, right?
Yes.
Is that why you are so optimistic? Because you just said fascinating, right? Not many people use the word fascinating in the international community. Mm. They are intrigued.
Yeah.
They are excited to see some really unexpected changes. Mm-hmm. They get excited when they hear interesting things from the mouth of the president, of Uzbekistan. But you're excited. I mean, we follow your social media posts, specifically, you tweet on a regular basis, and you spread the message of optimism.
But I am optimistic, and I am fascinated by the change process of this country. I think
But you're not naive.
No, I don't think I am. Mm-hmm. But in our area of work, we have not seen a wrong move in the last 1.5 years. We have seen the wages go up. We have seen now a ban on recruiting staff from state budget organizations. No more recruitment of teachers, nurses, doctors, etc. We have seen a reduction of cotton production, especially targeting the low yield areas with lower population densities. All the policies, everything we have seen is in line with our recommendations. So why would I not be optimistic?
Yeah, but I'm sure there have been moments when you hear something that makes you a bit uncomfortable, from the officials here in this country. Like, have you been such incidents where you're like, what are you saying? That's not really in line with what we want to do. I mean, the reform process isn't smooth, obviously, right? Mm. And the way the process is explained here by the policymakers, by the decision makers, including, president, isn't always very crystal clear. There's a lot of vagueness in messaging.
Well, that's true for politics and for anywhere in the world, isn't it? But I think, perhaps, and to answer your question, to get to your point, I think for us who work in the country on a daily basis and have these conversations with the policymakers directly, I think we get an insight into what is going on and how genuine this reform process really is.
How things being framed and...
Exactly. And I think maybe that's part of why I am optimistic, and I'm not afraid to say that, because we see so many things so close that I appreciate if you're not in the country, if you're outside, and you may not get the same insight. So policymakers internationally rely on the information that we and others convey to them.
I was interviewing a young journalist yesterday who's one of the founders of this new media, sources in the country. And when I asked him about what makes him feel so optimistic, he gave a very interesting answer, very similar to yours, actually. He said that, we're in the inside. Like, and as insiders, what we see are mostly what's moving us forward.
Mm-hmm.
So he said, it's good for us to hear your criticism from the outside because you obviously see more.
Yeah.
But if you've always been, an insider, I've always been, I've always lived in the country. And for me, it's just moving forward and forward and forward. And there are more options, and then there is more to do, and there are more challenges. And that's what makes me feel so optimistic.
Yes.
So just like him, you obviously appreciate the outside view too.
I do appreciate the art of you. I think it's legit and it's valid. Perception is reality, and so totally. We listen and we hear people expressing concerns and doubts. But I must say that to echo what this journalist told you, the statements made by, for example, the president or other senior government officials, we can really see how that is followed up by genuine implementation, and the directions are taken through the government structures. Of course, and this is where we are now, it's when we get out to the provinces, to the districts, that's where the work is now. The work for us is not in Tashkent. The work for us is out in the provinces, in the districts. That's where the implementation is happening right now.
Well, good luck, and thank you.
Thank you.
This is a wonderful conversation. I really appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you.